This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
And you're listening to History Teachers Talking Podcasts. All right, this is Peter Sablocki and Thomas Reska, and welcome back to the podcast. What do we got, Tom?
Well, today, kind of based on what's going on in the world, and you're particularly the United States, obviously the world too, with the COVID vaccine, we figured that it would be a good idea to kind of go back and look at the history of vaccines, some of the more famous and more influential vaccines that have affected the human population over the course of the centuries, and then also maybe look at some diseases that were actually wiped out by vaccines.
Yep. I think we probably should also mention a little bit about, I mean, the idea of like autism and vaccines and kind of some of the controversies between vaccines. And I guess also at the same time, I don't think this podcast is meant to entice anyone.
No, we're not saying pro or against. We're just saying this,
yeah.
This is just kind of the history of vaccines. They've been around for a lot longer than probably people think, in different ways, shapes, and forms. And that's what we're really going to look at, because in some cases, they were very successful. You can't argue that. We're just looking at the history. We're just looking at the history of it.
That's all it is. We're just talking about some vaccines. You know, hopefully a nice short episode for you guys. So, vaccines.
Well, I think it's important to know that, like the story, they don't begin. The first vaccine that's kind of like talked about or referenced the first vaccine was Edward Jenner, right? The idea he creates materials from.
By the way, this is 1796. So this is like really a long time ago. So
he uses cowpox, like these cowpox, like the pus basically, to provide protection against smallpox. But it actually starts long before that. A lot of this infectious disease that humans have. There are a lot of other ways they used to use smallpox material to provide immunity for disease. I remember watching, what was that? The miniseries a long time ago. Remember John Adams? The miniseries?
Yeah, good show.
And what they did was they would show what they used to do a lot, how they would inoculate some people for smallpox. And his family, they got it this way, is they would take a someone who is more or less dying from smallpox and like cut off like some of those, their sores, like those
yeah, pulses, like pus, right? Like they're taking the pus, get the pus out.
They would cut one of those off, like deep tissue, and kind of just smush it and goop it up, and then they would cut you very deep in your arm, like to the muscle, and then take this pus that was in there and just basically just like stick it underneath your arm and then wrap your arm up real tight, and you were going to get sick. Like that's what was going to happen. The idea is you're getting it when it's weaker, and then your immune system could fight off, and that's what a lot of people did. That's what John Adams' wife and his children got done. They got sick. They all survived, but you know, it was kind of a, you know, controversial, especially back then. But that was one of the ways people do it. We're going to infect you, have your immune system fight it off. You're going to get a weaker version. That's kind of how the early vaccines were, right? It was a weaker version of the virus. Things change over time. But there's evidence that exists that Chinese employ a lot of these smallpox inoculations or stuff like that as early as 1000 CE, right? It was practiced in Africa and Turkey as well before it ever spread to the America. In Europe and the Americas. So this was a common practice. Like again, vaccines or trying to combat illnesses like that by using the illness in some way is nothing new in human history.
Yep. And I mean, I do want to touch upon a little bit about the so-called official, Edward Jenner vaccine discovery. As you mentioned, it is obviously by no means the first one. But yeah, I also know that George Washington was inoculated the same way, I'm pretty sure, with the smallpox vaccine.
Yeah.
Which does this idea is that it provides a live but kind of reduced virus, right?
Yeah.
So Jenner, however,
and we kind of have to talk about smallpox too. I mean, smallpox ravaged the world. Like this was a horrible, horrible disease, and it's one that's pretty much eradicated now.
They said officially the one that is completely gone from the world, except from two places. It's still a live virus in two different labs. One is in Russia and one is in the United States. In the world where the virus still exists.
Because it was last reported naturally in 1977.
Yep. So I think we'll get into it. Actually, that's a good segue. Talk about smallpox. So let's get into Jenner and his view, or rather his discovery of a first vaccine for smallpox. And then we'll get into smallpox and talk a little bit about smallpox. So Edward Jenner was an English country physician, and the term vaccine actually derives from a Latin word, vaccinus, which means pertaining to cows. And there obviously is a reason for that, as you mentioned before. They said that, yes, he definitely didn't discover vaccines, but he kind of laid the groundwork for a field of how to immunize somebody. You know what I mean? Like the idea of immunity and creating herd immunity, and definitely in this relation to smallpox. As you mentioned, he basically looked at dairy maids and realized that dairy maids were often infected with cowpox, which is a virus that is very similar to smallpox, but it jumps from animals, including cows, but it could jump to humans. And all that it kind of causes is this mild infection, and usually it's just sores. So it was the same type of virus. It was just much weaker. And if a human being got this cowpox, again, it would be a rash, and it would call it a day. So the way he looked at it, Jenner, that is, he thought, all right, let's take some of – so he cut these
– bumps, filled bumps. It like this. That's thick better. Fluid, right, yep. And stuff like that.
First of all, it's the young dairy maid's name was Sarah Nelms, and he collects some few drops of fluid, right, from her sores. That's the word I was looking for. And then he injects his fluid into a healthy young boy's arm, and then they're kind of waiting. It's a waiting game, right? So the first thing is the boy never was infected with cowpox or smallpox, right? But he did develop a mild fever, some pain in the armpits shortly after this inoculation, which is considered like the first real inoculation. And then 9 days later, he wound up getting the chills, loses his appetite, so on and so forth. But then Jenner waits 2 months, and that was like the big moment of truth. He then infects the boy with fluid from a fresh smallpox sore, which at the time was super deadly, which we're going to get into right now. So like the fact that he's doing this to this boy is kind of crazy. You know, it's like, yeah, you might live. Let's try this. And the boy
he was a human guinea pig then.
Literally. Like, yeah, and the boy never became sick.
James Phillips.
Yes, that was the boy.
James Phillips was the boy's name, yeah.
And he never became sick. He was, and that's when it was like, whoa, so if we could inject you with a lesser form of a virus, then you can become immune to it. And that was the basically fundamentals of having vaccination. I mean, this is kind of how what they use going forward. But let's talk about smallpox. I mean, smallpox is, I mean, again, we already said it's pretty much eradicated, and it only exists in these two labs that are permitted to possess it. But what was smallpox?
It was a horrible disease. They don't really know when it started. They think it might have started in Egypt, but it's basically these bumps in that were scab of the body would leave scars. It could kill you. Could even if you recovered from it, you'd have deep, deep scarring, which is actually something that the the vaccine used to do. A lot of times you'd that like circle scar that a lot of people would see on their arm, particularly people who would come in from other countries. We'd have to get the smallpox vaccine if they didn't already have it, and it would leave like kind of this indentation of a circle on their shoulder. I wouldn't say early vaccines, but I guess vaccines up until like the 80s, right? Nowadays, I don't believe they even give smallpox vaccines to children anymore.
No, because it's gone.
I think we were some of the last ones to get it in like the 80s and stuff like that. We're dating ourselves, but because it's just eradicated, it doesn't exist anymore.
But historically, I think this is also important to say that this was one of the first official biological warfare weapons, agents.
Yes, yes.
Smallpox.
Yeah. They would take... Anyway,
French and Indian War, the British were huge with this. Like, this was like the British version of biological warfare.
Remember, smallpox wipes out a huge number of Native Americans also. Yep. I mean, that's something that we can talk about at some other time too. This, we always talk about we're going to do one on like the Plains Indians and stuff like that. But I mean, smallpox, they had no immunity to it whatsoever in their genes. So when that gets exposed to them, forget it.
Yeah, it's kind of, they started using it in the French and Indian Wars, 1750s, 1760s. And then also the British commanding officers ordered it, smallpox against Native Americans. But during American Revolutionary War, it was also used by our side, namely George Washington, used it as well to fight against Native Americans, which is nuts. You know that during World War II, scientists from UK, US, and Japan actually were involved in research into producing like a biological weapon from smallpox that was supposed to be released into the air. Kind of like bombs that would explode above cities and towns. But the plans for this large-scale production were never really carried through because they considered the weapon, by then, the wide-scale availability of the vaccine and the success of the vaccine kind of nullified it.
Yeah, made it that it wasn't worth it. Yeah.
Yep. And they were like, well, all right, I guess we're not going to go through with that.
Well, they find something else.
But, yeah. Well, yeah, to say the least.
Again, I mean, this isn't a podcast about smallpox, but just it just how it was used and how it was seen. Like a lot of former U.S. presidents, like you said, Washington, Jackson, Lincoln, they all contract and recover from the disease. Yeah. So like it was very common for people to get it and get badly scarred from it. You hear like saying like pox marks and stuff like that. That's one reason why they would a lot of times, even men during this that time, the 1700s, were makeup and stuff to kind of cover all their those marks that they had from when they had smallpox. It scarred you. If you survived it, it was not like you just like woke up and you were fine.
We should also say that it took a long time, like, to eradicate this thing. I mean, we know for a fact this thing existed like 3,000 years ago, and we know this because of kind of, you know, a little touching back to our old podcast, Mummy, right? Ramses the Fifth, which is Ramses the Fifth died more than 3,000 years ago, and essentially when we studied the Egyptian mummy of Ramses, we figured out that based on DNA stuff, he had smallpox. And again, that's 3,000 years ago, which is crazy. But as you mentioned also, besides Egypt, there's also medical writings from ancient India and China, which kind of specify that this has been around for a long time. All right, so let's talk some other diseases that we could potentially...
Well, I think another major one that I think was a major vaccine that really changed the world was definitely the rabies vaccine, right? In 1885 by Louis Pasteur. And Louis Pasteur has a couple different vaccines. He's actually, he created a few different ones or helped create a few different ones. But I think, again, you hear of rabies now, but rabies was a big problem also. Especially just the risk of getting bitten by an animal. It's still around there, getting bit by an animal that has rabies, but it was almost like a death sentence. And it still is if you get it, but if you get the vaccine, if you get the shots, within a short amount of time after you get bitten by an animal, that's pretty much what they do no matter what now. If you get bit by a wild animal, they're going to say, well, they don't even test you for rabies. They're just like, they're going to give you the rabies shot first and test you for rabies later because you need to have that in your system. You get it from bats, right? That was a big problem, I know. But in most countries, it was with wild dogs carried disease. In some countries, wild dogs, 99% of them carried rabies at one time or another. It's just nuts if you think about that.
Yep. Did you read about how he actually went about doing it, Pastor? He prevented rabies in 9-year-old Joseph Meister, I guess.
Who got bit by a dog, yeah.
Right? So they're saying that, the mother brought this boy severely bitten by, a dog, and Pasteur kind of hopes to prevent this disease. And there's several factors, though, that supposedly made Pasteur's potential involvement in the boy's care kind of controversial. One was the fact that when he said this to his mother, okay, I could save your son, he actually never used this successfully, this vaccine that he created. They said that before it was successful, he used the vaccine on a human twice, right? And this is indicated in Pasteur's notebooks. One involved a 6-year-old man who left the hospital after only one injection and never returned. So he never really knew if this worked. The other was a 10-year-old girl that he treated with one injection, and she died before the second it could be given. At the time, this is, 1885, I think.
Untested. A lot of people don't believe somewhat this. Tested. They didn't have the tested on two people? usually there's a lot more. There wasn't as much government oversight over vaccines as there is now.
No, it was super controversial. I mean, the thought of injecting a human being with a disease agent, even a weekend one, was not only new, but it was super controversial. Wait, what are you doing? There's a disease. You're basically making my daughter sick. What are you doing? So 1800s.
Rabies was a horrible disease. It was a violent attacking disease that attacked basically the inflamed the brain. So
did you know that Pasteur was actually a scientist, right? Not a physician, which is very important. It's because when the mother brought this boy over, and he's like, "All right, let me try this. In this new vaccine I have on him." If this boy did not survive, he would have been trialed for murder or manslaughter, rather. Do you know what I mean? Exactly. He wasn't a medical doctor. So crazy. I think it was 13 injections, by the way, for the first one.
Even now, I believe it's several injections into your stomach, right?
Yeah.
Your liver and things like that, right? It's not it's still a intense vaccine. It's not just a one shot in the arm type of vaccine. Yeah. I don't believe saw they were saying it's still a lot. But it was a disease that if you got it, it was a 95% death rate if you had it.
Nice.
If you had full blown rabies, you weren't recovering from it. Your body wasn't recovered for it. And I think one of the last persons in the United States to die from it, when it hadn't happened for years, was in 2011 actually, from a man in Utah, but they said he had extensive exposure to bats. He was basically bitten by bats and lived with bats for a long time. And that's how he just had rabies, but he had a lot of rabies, basically, they said.
Ooh. Did you know that there's actually a cool end to that story? Because The boy winds up never developing rabies. The incident is regarded as a success. We have the first vaccine against rabies. But later in life, the boy, as an old man, worked as a caretaker of Pasteur's tomb in Paris. Full circle. What? All right. What's another one we got? I think the one we really need to talk about, and I feel like whether we talk about it now or later, we definitely need to get out of the way, and that is polio.
Yes, that's a big one. Yes,
polio is huge, and polio in itself,
that's another one too. Like just ravaged people.
Polio is a viral infection, right? It lives inside a person's throat initially and intestines. And one in four people who catch the disease develop flu-like symptoms. And most of the time, one in four of these, right, the symptoms are just kind of like, oh, I have the flu and it goes away. But the three out of four, so three quarters of the people that get polio suffer severe effects, which include paralysis and respiratory failure.
Iron lungs, right?
Yeah, I was going to get to that. So if you guys are out there listening to this, you just Google this. But some infected children would spend weeks inside these like giant machines called iron lungs. And if you Google them, they look like something out of this world. Basically, the head would be out and everything else would be in this like incubator. And what the incubator did was like constrict air, basically. It like took your whole body.
Press it down.
Yeah, and like press it down and then move it up. They would change the pressure of the air in there and literally make you breathe.
Yeah, you used to see them a lot. I remember in like the Bugs Bunny cartoons after like Wile E. Coyote got like crushed by like his own inventions.
Yep.
At the end, we always say, like, inside Acme Iron Lung, and you see them inside those. That's where I remember seeing that as like a kid. And what's that? And I remember reading a story not too long ago about there's like still like one guy in the United States that still uses an iron lung. And wow. Like, it's really difficult now because like you can't get the parts for it. So he has to like buy the parts off like eBay and things like that.
What?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
But there's so much newer technology. Plus, polio is also mostly eradicated for them.
Well, from the United States, it's gone. Yeah, actually, the last States, reported case of polio in the U.S. was like early 1990s. And the reason is because the patient actually contracted a disease abroad. By 1979, the disease was considered eliminated completely from the United States. And that's just, think about it, and that's only, since vaccine was really introduced, silk vaccine was really introduced in 1950, you know, like 55, really.
It was a massive campaign, yeah. And you see, like, you'd see like newspaper headlines basically talking about how effective the vaccine was, like saying like this works.
Oh,
like encouraging people to do it because it was a huge epidemic. And you would have 30,000 people dying. I mean, a lot of them were children too, like dying every year. So they needed to have this. And it was it was a very again controversial, but also like relief when they realized it had some sort of vaccine for a lot of parents. Like now you don't have to worry about my child getting sick and they might contract polio.
Yeah, I mean, NPR, just kind of both of those. According to NPR, 3,000 U.S. children died from polio in 1952 alone. 50s was like a big one. Right before the vaccine was invented, it was really where a lot of this spiked. And then going back to this PR idea that you just mentioned, Elvis Presley, there's a picture. I don't know if you could probably Google it. Basically, it's this picture of Elvis Presley, like kind of, smiling at this nurse who's like probably twice his age. But as a doctor injects him with polio vaccine, and this is backstage of the Ed Sullivan Show in New York, right? So like he goes on a show and he's photographed and filmed getting vaccinated. Like it was such a huge campaign. And in fact, the polio deaths in the early 50s were so common that companies would sell polio insurance to parents of newborns. Like if you were, your kid was just born, you get like a little pamphlet in the mail, like, hey, here's polio insurance, that for that day when your child might become, it's nuts, right? Like paralyzed. This is insane. But it spread rapidly, obviously, amongst younger populations because it was transmitted orally. So they said it was easy to be transmitted in places like public swimming pools and daycare centers and so on and so forth, which kind of, allowed for that to grow. But if you look at the history of polio, there is, and this is from like hieroglyphics. So this is another thing that's kind of crazy when you look at this. They're thinking, again, going back to Egypt, like there is Egyptian paintings and cave carvings that depict otherwise healthy people that are young with withered limbs and children walking with canes at a young age.
The bow-legged.
Yeah. And they're like, all right, it's been around for thousands of years. This is kind of interesting too, because before 20th century, right? Polio infections were very rarely seen in infants before 6 months of age at all. And most cases occurred to kids like that are anywhere like under 4 years old. But poor sanitation in like 18th, 19th century. So I'm talking 1700s and 1800s. Poor sanitation resulted in constant exposure to the virus, which actually enhanced the natural immunity, like almost like a herd immunity with the populations of Europe, as well as the United States, for against polio, which is why you didn't really hear about polio that much in the 1800s. It was kind of subdued because actually people were dirtier and therefore exposed to it more, and it kind of became immune to it. And then what starts to happen is as nations start to develop, European nations and the United States, 1900s really like develop, late 1800s, early 1900s, they said that in developed countries during the late 19th and early 20th century, because these improvements were made in community sanitations, like better sewage disposal, clean water supply, so on and so forth, these changes actually increased the proportion of children and adults at risk of, you know, getting polio infections because it reduced the childhood exposure and immunity to the disease. And that's when you start seeing these like localized polio epidemics appear in Europe and the United States around 1900. And then you have outbreaks that reaches pandemic proportions in Europe, North America, Australia by 1950, you know, which is like the peak. They say by 1950 is the peak of the epidemic. And this epidemic is now gone. I mean, like I said, it's eradicated since the 70s in the United States due to a successful vaccine. Although that's like big, do you know that? That's like Bill Gates' big thing now. He's trying to get rid of polio from the world.
They want to get, well, because there are several countries that actually you can't even travel to unless you have the polio vaccine. You have to prove that you have it because they won't even let you in the country. And there's other countries that still have this big distrust, like parts of Pakistan and parts of Afghanistan where the Taliban controls. They don't trust the vaccine. And actually, there was like doctors who were administering the vaccine actually were killed. Mm-hmm. There's a couple on those cases, so it makes it much harder. There's three major regions, basically in parts of Africa and parts of the Middle East that are still considered endemic countries when it comes to not pandemic, but endemic countries when it comes to polio. That they still have outbreaks and stuff there. I mean, it's very hard to get it out to administer the vaccine because so many people are distrusting. And yes, they even distrust. Bill Gates, a lot of them, because they think he's got like computer chips in the vaccine and stuff like that.
Yeah. And although it was mostly children and especially infants that were most affected, the most famous adult affected probably was the future president, Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was stricken with polio at the age of 39 in 1921, which left him partially paralyzed. He later transformed his estate, would you hear about this, like Warm Springs, Georgia, into like a recovery retreat for polio victims.
He was in pain a lot for polio too.
Yeah.
Like it was never really reported as much as when he was president, but there was, he had polio, it kind of limits his ability to walk. No, he could not walk. He was in a wheelchair. And that wasn't really publicized as much, you know, during his presidency as much as it is known after the fact. But
yeah. And he also is the reason why so much money, he was also the reason why so many funds were raised for polio related research. And the guy that creates the vaccine, his name was Salk, right? Salk,
yeah.
Last name was Salk. I want to say it was Dr. Jonas Salk.
Jonas,
that's what it was. So Dr. Jonas Salk actually initially kind of was a medical student, and during World War II he was helping develop the flu vaccine, and then right post-war he is kind of like chosen to become the head of this research laboratory in Pittsburgh, and is given a grant by the federal government to study the polio virus. What's really cool about this is that once he creates the virus, he could patent it, like if he wanted to. You know what I mean? Like he could become a very, very wealthy guy, and he chooses not to.
Yeah, because that was like a famous thing we were talking about that. Yeah, because he wanted to get rid of it for. That's not why he did it.
Yeah, he goes, I did it so I could get rid of and eradicate this disease. Like I want to help cure children and prevent the disease. So instead of getting paid for it, like he just released it and said any company can make this vaccine go. And they did, you know, and that's why there was such a huge, you know, campaign to get it going, because any company could make this vaccine because he didn't patent it. Like he was like, you can't patent something like this. Go. And I mean, again, in today's day and age,
someone's going to patent it.
Yeah. Someone's making money off this.
But it's also there'll be like rival companies like what you have with the COVID vaccines, like multiple companies creating it, right?
Yep.
Their own versions of it.
All right. What else do you have? Mumps?
Well, I think another one that kind of carries with mumps is the measles vaccine, right?
Yes. Yep.
Because the measles vaccine, you can actually, You can get it by itself, but you can also get it with a MMR, the MMR vaccine, which is a combination of several vaccines, the rubella vaccine, the mumps vaccine, also a variation with chickenpox vaccine. They kind of put it all together, more or less, right? Kind of in like a cocktail, if you want to say it that way. And that's kind of given to people. Because measles is another one of those like really infectious diseases that people don't usually develop an immunity to right away. So you need to have a vaccination. And it's one that's pretty much, it was declared Iraq in the United States in what, 2016, I believe. You know, there's been a few cases. And they're thinking one reason why a lot of these cases were, again, people traveling abroad or people coming in from other countries that had the have not yet had the vaccine and brought the disease back with them. So they were seeing some things with it, with that. But the history of the vaccine, again, it's based on John Franklin Enders, who shared a lot of his medical work. He won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his work on the polio virus and some of the other viruses. And one of the people who basically got information from the Faye School was Thomas E. Pebbles. And he basically was the one that helped create this vaccine, kind of isolate the materials that they needed to be able to use it. And the vaccine was developed based on that.
Yep.
Based off of a 11-year-old boy's virus.
Yeah. And Edmondson, the idea of combining these, strain. And but they had, you know, we also have to say that there were successful standalone vaccines for measles, which was in 63, mumps, which was 67, and rubella, am I saying that right?
But the MMR one is the one that's probably most people 69. Listen to this podcast, are getting because it was a combination. Like we can, the diseases were very similar. They were able to isolate these strands. It really is like fascinating to look at it and like hear about how they create these things. And this is on the microscopic level that they're figuring this stuff out. You know?
Yeah, 1989 is when they officially created this, like in a sense that, all right, there's a second. They also decide like this isn't something you take in one dosage. Like this
You get one, which one of them was actually said was about 92% effective. But then you get that second, like the booster shot. You get that booster shot. I always remember hating to get those. Remember when you were like a little kid?
Yep.
You got the one shot and you knew you had it. You're going to have to come back in like a couple of weeks for another one. You're like, oh, man.
Dude, I mean, I don't.
There's a big list of vaccinations now. I remember when, you know, my first son was born. You're just looking at the list of all these things they're getting vaccinated for, and you're like, wow, like wow.
I'm pretty sure you don't like. I mean, when I was little, I had chickenpox. I don't think you're gonna have chickenpox anymore. I think
you don't hear about it as much. You don't hear about
because there's a vaccine. I'm pretty sure my kid will never. Well, yeah, he's vaccinated. He'll never have chickenpox.
Yeah, you get vaccinated for it.
I remember having chickenpox, and it sucked, man.
I remember getting it. Yeah, I remember.
People would be, chickenpox parties. Parents would be like, all right, so-and-so has a chickenpox.
Yeah, which I'm not sure how smart of an idea that probably was.
I know, but it was like, go over to their house and let's get this out of the way. Yeah,
the idea is to expose to it. I remember South Park did an episode on that where they found out that's why their parents wanted them to do that. So then they got mad and then put another virus on their parents' toothbrush and made sure they all got this other virus. I'm not going to say the virus, but it begins with an H and ends with a P.
Nice. But that was a real thing. For those of you guys listening that are young enough, they used to have these chicken pox parties where they would be like, hey, Johnny has it. Go over his house, everyone, and we're going to get sick. And you guys are all quarantined at home and you won't have to worry about it again. Because if you get chicken pox when you're younger, it's actually not so bad. Like, but if you get chicken pox rather when you're older,
it could kill you.
It could kill you.
Well, it could become shingles, right?
Yep. That's what it was.
Yeah.
So, yeah, vaccine. I mean, this is nuts. So it's like you said, like this is more than one booster. Just like, so I got Pfizer of COVID. I got both of my shots a while back, but I'm now hearing in the news that I'm probably going to need a booster. Did you get Pfizer or did you get Moderna, Tom?
Mine was the Moderna, I believe. Yeah, Moderna.
See, so you're probably not as of now. I'm going to need a booster, but we'll see. I mean, it's like trying to get my kids to get shots, dude. Like Landon literally climbed when he was little. My son, I was trying to hold him and he was climbing over me and he like climbed over my back and he's like a Spider-Man upside down my back. And I finally turn around, I look at the nurse and she's standing there with the needle, right? And she's like, do you really expect me to give him a shot this way? And I'm like, nope, I'll fix it. You know, but I'm petrified.
Oh, yeah, it's where you have to like hold your kid down while they're getting like a needle.
They're screaming.
This is
and great. Then you promise things you shouldn't promise. Like, you know, back in the day, it was like, I'll take you to Toys R Us. But now I can't even say that because no more Toys R Us.
No more Toys R Us. Future podcast.
Future podcast. Bam. Stores. What do we call it? We should call it stores and that are no longer here. Stores and businesses.
Stores of yesteryear. Stores of yesteryear.
That's a good one. I like that.
There you go.
All right, Tommy. What else we got? We just hit up mumps, measles, and rubella. Like, dude, that just took it all out in one shot.
Well, that took out a bunch. Well, again, because that's what they have now. They have these vaccines that are able to get these horrible diseases knocked out. And you just think of all these different diseases that are out there that are just, you know, waiting to take you out, you know?
Yeah.
But I think another one that was a pretty common, that was killing people, particularly if you were older, was tetanus.
Yes.
Right? And this is still like a vaccine. It's kind of similar to the rabies vaccine, is that it's not just one or two doses. It's actually five doses are recommended for tetanus, sometimes a sixth later on in adolescence. And usually you're immune after three, but you're actually going to get these over the course of several years of tetanus shots. And sometimes if you're exposed, you know, if you might get some that they say, oh, you might need a tetanus shot, you're going to get an extra one, you know?
Yeah. High risk. This one's been around for a while. This is one of those very first vaccines. This is 1924, and it came into common use really and didn't really become super common until World War II. It was used for soldiers. I mean, it literally decreased tetanus in soldiers from World War I to World War II, American soldiers, by 95% rate of tetanus.
Yeah, it was a highly effective one. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, how about this one? Because I started, when I was looking at this, I you know, researching for this, I also came across this idea of creating immunity in poisons. Like, is it possible for you, like you see this, you know, sometimes, and historically you've seen this actually happened in Egypt. I forgot the guy's name, where he started trying to take poison every day to like make himself more
immune to it.
Yeah,
I've heard that too.
King Mithridates or something. Mithridates.
He had some of those. It also was a guy who used to purposely like let himself get bit by snakes. Just a little bit.
That's crazy.
And so he slowly built up like the anti-venom in his body to the point where like now if a snake bites him, he's just like fine. Doesn't even affect him because your body just is ready for it.
So by the way, takes you into like, all right, now click next, and because now I was curious, so that totally took me off the tangent. So since I spent time on it researching this podcast, I'm going to talk about it. FYI, if you take a little bit of poison,
don't talk about people taking poison.
No, I'm not saying you should take poison, Tom.
You're going to give people ideas here.
No, this is a legitimate. I got this from a scientific study. The answer is, if you take poison, you do not become immune to it. If you take a little bit of poison. Just so we're on the same page. That is actually an urban legend. Quite frankly, most poisons or stuff that are in poison become stored in the fatty acids of a person's body. And what happens is they never actually go away per se. It takes a long time. So they're saying if you take I'll take a little dosage here and next week I'll take another dosage and another dosage. All you're really doing is just it's being stored in your body, which means ultimately at some point you are actually going to overdose on that poison and kill yourself. Some scientific studies say that it may stimulate the body into like upping its output of output of like immunity. But all it's simply doing is that it takes a little longer to kill you, but it still really, really kills you. So
it's still a poison. Outside agent that's coming into your body. It's gonna mess you up.
This is kind of off tangent too, but this made me think of when like we study in the jungle, you know, and you talk about like industrialization and stuff in the United States, how they used to have before you have like Food and Drug Administration, they used to literally put bread that was laced with rat poison and throw it over like cut meat in butcher shops and warehouses across the United States to try to fight the rat infestation. And then the rats would run around the meat, eat this poison, and then altogether just die on the meat. And then everything would go in a grinder and they would like make sausage. That was before, you know, Food and Drug Administration. It's insane. Yeah.
Good job they stepped in.
Yeah, you know, again, it's been a while since we went off tangent on these podcasts. So it was time.
Yeah, we were sticking to it for a while.
Yeah, we were good. We've been good.
Have those. I guess we can talk about like just briefly. Like I know, I guess we're talking about the vaccines and how people get them and stuff like that. But there is also a lot of people who don't trust vaccines. We touched on a little bit, and there are adverse side effects at some times. Like typically, most doctors will say that they are safe, but there are side effects no matter what. Like you're going to get, because you are getting, your body's having a reaction to it. It's fighting off the virus in some cases, or it's replicating the proteins to fight the virus. So you're going to have side effects a lot of times, like fever, pain around the injection site, muscle aches. Some people are actually allergic to the vaccines, ingredients in the vaccine.
Yeah. So a lot There's one particular, it's a mercury based that goes into many vaccines. Most of the vaccines actually until like mid 2000s contained this specific ingredient called thimerosal. I'm probably totally butchering that. And it was a mercury based preservative that was used to kind of prevent contamination of multi-dose vials of vaccines. And it went to most vaccines and research. That's really the one, that one specific ingredient that was attached to this thought that vaccines would contribute to ADHD. And because of the levels of mercury within them. However, it is interesting that between 1999 and 2001, this thimerosal or whatever was removed in all childhood vaccinations, except some flu vaccines still have it. But for the most part, it was removed. Therefore, scientifically speaking, apparently there is no correlation between autism and vaccines. However, it is also, I should note, based on my research into this, a topic that is, according to the CDC,
it's a hot topic.
Yeah, it's still being, it's not like it's a close case. It's not like they're saying vaccines don't, but they're not saying the vaccines do. They're saying they don't, but we're still looking into it.
Yeah, they're still looking into it. They're still going to explore. Because I think, believe the doctor who originally wrote the paper has since come out and said he's changed his stance. I should have actually looked up his name. But it's one of those issues that even if it's proven one way or the other, people are still not going to believe it, no matter which one it is.
Yeah. You know, once you send
depending on where you, before you are, once it's out there. And a lot of times people aren't going to, they're just going to believe what they want, or they're going to find information to back what they want. And that's, you know, that is what it is.
Yeah.
In some cases.
There is technically today 14 infectious diseases, according to the CDC, that were once very prevalent in the U.S. before the development of vaccines for each of them. I'm probably going to mispronounce some of them, but the diseases that are pretty much eradicated, more or less, because of vaccines are obviously polio, tetanus, flu, hepatitis B, hepatitis A, rubella, Hib, measles, whooping cough, rotavirus, mumps, chickenpox. You know, these diseases were once considered epidemics, and they no longer are due to the fact that vaccines were created for them. And developing vaccines is really not that, you know, it's a process. So the path that researchers have to take with a potential vaccine is very much defined and overseen by the FDA. And once researchers create a potential vaccine, the producer must apply with the FDA and first describing the product, but also the manufacturing process, and importantly, its effectiveness in animal testing. So it's almost like they have to basically say this works on animals before FDA approves for them to go into the three clinical trials. And the clinical trials are kind of laid out in phases. And this is regardless whether we're talking about COVID or any,
the little difference is this usually takes years to do.
Yeah. But with you know COVID, what I read as to why it takes years? So there's three phases, right? And I'll tell you kind of what I at least read about the time frame. But phase one is evaluates the vaccine safety and ability to generate just an immune system response. It's a very small group of people seeing, hey, does this work on humans?
Does this work?
If it doesn't work on humans, phase one, over, vaccine's done. If it does work on a few group of people, you know, humans, it does generate immune system response. Then it goes to phase two, and now you're specifically selecting hundreds of people and to determine the right dosage level. So the first phase is
viral load, right? All that
exactly, stuff. Right? First dose is just like, does it create immunity? Second one is, okay, what dosage does needed? And you use hundreds of people for that. And then phase three, this is where you test thousands of people, and now you're analyzing the safety and effectiveness of the drug on the overall population. And once these results of the clinical trials are available, only then can the vaccine itself be released to the public. However, what's happening with the coronavirus, there you have some, you know, this process was, as you said, kind of sped up a lot, and you have some emergency usage where, you know, you're kind of going out there when before you're done with all these phases. But I've also read...
It's also an RNA vaccine, which is much different.
Yes.
It's not actually using the virus, it's using like the
like the DNA particles or something.
Yeah,
like
composed of the DNA. Nucleic acid. Yeah, the RNA, the nucleic acid.
And what it does is your body starts to create an immune system when your DNA recognizes the agent. I mean, the science here is this, again, we're history teachers, right?
Yeah. So this is a little bit out of our wheelhouse.
Yeah.
But it's still, I do find it very interesting. It's one of those things that's like the fact that the human race can create antibodies, can create virus, can create these anti you know, viruses and
it's nuts.
These vaccines to go after, you know, these microscopic agents that are, you know, ravaging our society. All right. It's very interesting.
But a few things. There is like a genetic recipe that is designed to make vaccines now, which it makes the creation of vaccines actually very quick, which is also why the coronavirus vaccine was created like a year ago. And I mean, we're recording this podcast pretty much a year after the highest level of coronavirus. You know, so we're in April of 2021 when it's really spiked in the U.S. was April 2020. You know, vaccine was created fairly quickly. It just needed to go through these phases. They weren't going to just release it. They needed to do this. And they're saying, based on what I read, that it went, the vaccinations for COVID were kind of sped up in a sense that a lot of the bureaucracy hurdles were removed, you know, and that's what allowed for it to be jumping between these phases much quicker. Because
there's a lot of cooperation between a lot of different scientists from around the world. We're all working together. It wasn't just like kind of in their isolation in their own labs.
So you know what? Let's hope that one day someone will make a podcast and talk about diseases that once were, but they're now gone because of vaccines. And hopefully, the one that we are living with right now becomes one of those diseases.
Yeah, it's always good when you have another one bites the dust when some other ones are put on that list.
Yeah. So yeah, and obviously, you know, there's some setbacks like J&J. Taking a little pause. Out of said 7 million people were immunized by the Johnson & Johnson, and 6 people developed blood clots. So they paused it for now because there is a chance. So again, just some news. I'm done. You got anything else?
No, I think that was, we were pretty straightforward there.
Awesome. All right. Take care, everyone.
Stay safe.
I hope everyone enjoyed our podcast, and if you would like to email us, you can do so at historyteacherspodcast@gmail.com.